Our scripture this morning comes from 2 Kings, the second chapter. We'll begin in the very first verse and read all the way down to verse 14. This is what it says in 2 Kings chapter 2. When the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here. The Lord has sent me to Bethel." But Elisha said, "As surely as the Lord lives, as you live, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. The company of prophets at Bethel came out to Elisha and asked, "Do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today?" "Yes, I know," Elisha replied, "so be quiet." Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here, Elisha. The Lord has sent me to Jericho." And he replied, "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you." So they went down to Jericho. The company of prophets at Jericho went up to Elisha and asked him, "Do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today?" "Yes, I know," he replied, "so be quiet." Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here. The Lord has sent me to the Jordan." And he replied, "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you." So the two of them walked on. 50 men from the company of prophets went and stood at a distance, facing the place where Elijah and Elisha had stopped at the Jordan. Elijah took his cloak, rolled it up, and struck the water with it. The water was divided to the right and to the left, and the two of them crossed over on dry ground. When they had crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, "Tell me, what can I do for you before I am taken from you?" "Let me inherit a double portion of your spirit," Elisha replied. "You have asked a difficult thing," Elijah said. "Yet if you see me when I am taken from you, it will be yours. Otherwise, it will not." As they were walking along and talking together, suddenly a chariot of fire and horses of fire appeared and separated the two of them. And Elijah went up to heaven in a whirlwind. Elisha saw this and cried out, my father, the chariots and horsemen of Israel." And Elisha saw him no more. Then he took hold of his garment and tore it in two. Elisha picked up Elijah's cloak that had fallen from him, and went back and stood on the bank of the Jordan. He took the cloak that had fallen from Elijah and struck the water with it. "Where now is the Lord, the God of Elijah?" he asked. When he struck the water, it divided to the right and to the left, and he crossed over. This is the word of the Lord for us, the people of God. Thanks be to God. This story of Elijah and Elisha is a fairly famous one. Elijah, after all, is this hero prophet of Israel. He has done the unbelievable, feats unimaginable, except that the power of the Lord was working through him. This is the one, as Sharon mentioned, stood toe-to-toe with the prophets of Baal. The one who stood face-to-face with those rulers of the kingdom and told them what for. And now Elijah is coming to stand face to face with that thing that every leader must face, his own end. And in this story that we've read today, as Elijah comes to the end of his life and his ministry and begins to hand off the leadership of his ministry to Elisha, I believe it gives us an opportunity to consider God's plan for leadership succession. I believe that this story has something to say to those of us who find ourselves in leadership positions, those of us who might need to be reminded that our faith legacy depends at least in part on the success of our successors. And it has something to say to those of us waiting patiently in the wings for our chance to pick up the mantle and carry it forward. Particularly, we are to be reminded that as believers, when times of transition come, that is when the Spirit of God often does God's best work in preparing and equipping us as God's people to be able to ably step into the leadership positions to which we have been called. This thing, this ending well and transitioning to what is next, particularly with an eye toward one successor's success, is not unique only to those who are working in the world of faith. Jack Welch Jr., you may recall, was the CEO of GE for 20 years, from 1981 to 2001. And during his tenure at GE, the company did well. In fact, its market value increased 4,000%. Yet it was widely recognized as he transitioned out that Jack Welch's legacy would at least in part be determined in some ways more by what happened after he left than when he was there. You see, Welch's final decision as the CEO of GE was to handpick his own successor. And just a year after Welch had stepped down as CEO and his handpicked successor was in place, Business Week asked Jim Collins, that great leadership mind, if he would give Welch a level 5 leader rating. That's the highest accolade that Collins has for leaders. And Collins said his report card is still out. We won't really know how to rate Welch until Jeff Immelt, that's his handpicked successor, exceeds him. If he exceeds him, then he will have succeeded. But if he does not exceed him, then I say Jack Welch has failed. It takes 50 years to build a company like GE and generations of leaders to build it. And if Jack Welch is a level 5 or not, will come down to the answer to a question we don't know yet. Was Jack Welch first and foremost ambitious for himself or for GE? Only he knows that. Of course, that article now is nearly 20 years old, but just last year, a podcast that I listened to called Freakonomics, Stephen Dubner, the host, interviewed Jack Welch, and he was reflecting on his time as CEO at GE. And then he brought up the elephant in the room. Dubner said this, "Let me ask you, in 1999, not long before you retired from GE, you yourself said that your ultimate success will be determined by how well your successor grows the company over the next 20 years. With that said, GE's market cap then was just north of $450 billion, and now it's almost 20 years later, it's north now of $200 billion. So let me ask you about that. I know that you," and at this point, Welch interrupts and says, "I don't talk about that." And Dubner says, "I know you don't. Why not? I mean, it's public record." And Jack Welch responded and said, "You can comment on it any way you want, but I haven't commented on my successor once in 20 years, and I don't intend to comment now. You can judge me any way you want on whether I picked the right guy or not. You gave the numbers. And one from those numbers might question how well I did, but I'm not commenting. And if you want to give me a black mark, give me a black mark. I did the best I could. I picked the guy." There's something noble about that answer, to be sure. But the bottom line is, I did the best I could. I picked the guy. By the way, when the markets closed on Friday, GE's market cap is now under $92 billion. 20% of what it was when Jack Welch walked away. In fairness, Immelt stepped down as CEO in 2017. And of course, this isn't a business course. I wouldn't pretend to understand all the external and internal factors that led to GE's remarkable climb or their precipitous decline. But it stands to illustrate the point that even out there, beyond the stained glass windows, people recognize that part of how we judge a leader is by those who follow after them. And so as we've been reading together as part of the Foundations Plan through the Old Testament as a church, I've been struck over and again in the Old Testament all these great men of the Lord who are fathers to a generation that drifts from the Lord. There is, of course, Eli's sons and Samuel's sons and David's sons over and again to the point of almost being a trope. And it's for that reason, perhaps, that Elijah and Elisha's relationship stands out in the Old Testament. Theirs is not a biological relationship. It is the relationship between a disciple and a master. And it is clear that both men have intentionally related themselves in this relationship. It's been an intentional relationship of mentorship. And that might be the first principle we can lift out of this story today. That in God's design for leadership transition, there is to be intentional investment in relationship. Elijah makes this intentional investment in Elisha, and Elisha is faithful to invest himself in learning all he can from Elijah. That's clear throughout the story of their relationship, but we can see it clearly lived out here in this story. Three times Elijah says, "I'm called of the Lord to go over there," and Elisha says, "I'm going with you." And so it's clear that in those days there were whole crowds of seminary students, these collections called the Company of Prophets, and Elijah cares enough about them that in these last days of his ministry, he stops off at each of the campuses to check in on them. But there's something special about that relationship between Elijah and Elisha. Elisha was able not just to read about Elijah in books, but to see firsthand his work as a prophet. And if it is true that succession depends upon fidelity to the given responsibilities of one's ministry, Elijah made sure that Elisha knew what it took. Elisha learned firsthand to be a prophet from a person who was living it out, an expert in the field. So let me ask you this question. Whatever your field of choice, but particularly as a disciple of Jesus, with whom have you entered into an intentional relationship of mentoring? Disciples make disciples. So who is it that you are discipling? Who is it that you're teaching the way of the Lord? And equally important, who is it that is discipling you? Who are you following in their work to learn what God is calling you to do? Again, this isn't just about being handed a title. Way back in 1 Kings chapter 19, it's already been declared Elisha has the title. He is the heir apparent. Something more significant and deeper is happening in this story. It's a disciple-making relationship, yes. But even that, Elisha knows, is insufficient. And so, as they go on their final walkabout, Elijah and Elisha together, crossing through the Jordan on dry ground, smacking the water with the cloak, the sign of his prophetic office, bringing to mind for us Moses and the sea and Joshua and the Jordan. And Elijah asked Elisha, that's the first time I've messed that up, I think. I'm impressed with myself. Elijah asked Elisha, "Is there anything else? Is there anything else you need from me?" And Elisha responds with a stiff request. "Let me inherit a double portion of your spirit." Now, this isn't just Elisha being greedy. A double portion of the inheritance is what the heir, the firstborn son, always received. But he is recognizing that what he's observed Elijah do, even in the midst of this relationship, what he's seen happen, what he's been called to do now, is impossible if the Spirit of God is not at work in his life. It's not the sort of things one does just because they've been given a title, just because they've been put under somebody's wing. No, what God has called him to, undeniably, will require a work of God's Spirit in and through and alongside him. God's Spirit is of ultimate importance to Elisha's ministry and to ours. God's Spirit is that gift which will allow Elisha to do what he has been called to do. Elisha's request is, as one commenter has said, for a specially granted spiritual power beyond his own capabilities to meet the responsibilities of the awesome task that lay before him. He wished virtually that Elijah's mighty prowess might continue to live through him. But this is a hard truth. This gift is not Elijah's to give. It is God's alone. And what Elijah makes clear to Elisha is that you've asked a difficult thing. Yet when you see me taken away, it will be yours. Otherwise, it will not. This ability to see and comprehend the spiritual world, to visionarily penetrate the heavens, you'll have it or you won't. God will give it or God won't. But that doesn't mean, sisters and brothers, that we should sit idly by. We cannot force God to give us the gift of God's Spirit, but we can cultivate our lives so that our eyes are better open, our hearts more receptive to the good work God might be trying to do in us. The true spiritual perception of the proper order is a rare gift, but it's one that can be cultivated and treasured. And I would argue it was largely in his relationship with Elijah, being near to one who was near to God. It was largely there that Elisha was made ready to receive the good gift God had for him. Elisha's title is great. His mentoring is important. But true succession can only happen where there is true power. And true power for the believer comes only from the work of God's Holy Spirit in our lives. So these two are walking along in the wilderness, and Elijah is carried up into heaven in a whirlwind, an image of the Lord's coming. Elisha witnesses it. He sees it. He declares, "I've seen it. I've seen it." And he gets the gift. So not only does he have the title and the investment of his mentor, now he's received the gift of God's power, God's Spirit in his life. But there is, even at this point in the story, one more thing Elisha must do for this succession to really take place. When it comes down to it, Elisha has to pick up the mantle. Elisha has to choose to lead. It says in verse 13 and following, Elisha then picked up Elijah's cloak that had fallen from him and went back and stood on the bank of the Jordan. He took the cloak that had fallen from Elijah and struck the water with it. Where now is the Lord, the God of Elijah, he asked. And when he struck the water, it divided to the right and to the left, and he crossed over. God's plan for transitioning leadership requires those of us who are stepping into a role to be bold and taking up the mantle. But don't miss this. It also requires those who are moving out of the role, who've been wearing the mantle, to be willing to take it off and lay it down. The Fuller Youth Institute did some groundbreaking research in recent years, and they published a book of this research called Growing Young. In their book, they wanted to see if there were features of churches who were successfully engaging and retaining teenagers and emerging adults. And so they did this study with more than 250 congregations across the country, across denominational, geographic, racial, and other lines. And they compiled their research to learn that there were some things these churches had in common. These churches that were growing spiritually and emotionally and missionally and numerically with 15 to 29-year-olds. They walked away from their research having discovered at least six essential strategies to help young people discover and love your church. The first of these they call keychain leadership. And they illustrate the story of keychain leadership with the story of a young man named Stephen, who has the nickname Stretch. You see, when Stretch was 16, his town gave him his driver's license and his parents handed him the keys to the family car. He got to the end of the driveway and he had to make that decision. Where am I going to go? And he realized that at church he had been welcomed and loved, and probably the youth pastor might be in his office. And so he left his driveway and drove to the church and got out. And as he was getting out, one of the child care directors saw him and realized now he has a driver's license. They had a shortage of child care workers in the afternoon. And so she asked Stretch if he would like to come onto their team. He said, sure. And before he even knew what had happened, she reached in her pocket and pulled out a key. And she handed him a key to the church. He had this key to a car, and now he had a key to the church. And he didn't really listen to what she was saying, but she was talking about how sometimes he might have to lock up and he'd need a key to do that. But what struck him is that important people had this key. The pastor had this key. His youth pastor had the key. Deacons had this key. And now he had been handed this key. So he started working in the afternoons, and his youth pastor, seeing that Stretch was there anyway, said, hey, Stretch, the drink machine in the youth room, I hate having to fill it up. Would you be willing to fill it up for me when you're here in the afternoons? It comes with all the free Mountain Dew you can drink. This was the best week of Stretch's life. He had a key to a car, a key to a church, a key to endless Mountain Dew. And so there he is with his keys in hand, and he finds himself in the sanctuary of his church. And it's there where perhaps the greatest key was handed to him that week. Not in an audible way, but in a certain way. He heard God speak to him and said, Stretch, you really like it here, don't you? And that was the beginning of Stretch's call to ministry. For the last 20 years, because he was handed keys, literal and figurative keys, Stretch has been a youth pastor, discipling others and growing them in their faith. Nearly all of us who are called into some sort of leadership, we have a story like Stretch's. And it's our job to make sure that's someone else's story too. By keys, of course, I don't just mean physical keys and throwing fobs out. I mean leaders, deeply respected leaders, who are acutely aware of the keys they have on their keychain, entrusting and empowering others to take up the task. Aware of the keys they're holding, they offer keys to others, sometimes real keys, but sometimes a seat at the table. The point is this: you don't have to die, nor be taken up in a whirlwind, in order to hand leadership off to someone else. Vince Lombardi, the legendary American football coach, said, "In all my years of coaching, I've never been successful using someone else's plays." And the people who pick up the mantle you lay down, they won't do things the same way you did. But the spirit at work in them is the same spirit that is at work in you. And after all, it wasn't the mantle that had the power to split the water, just like it wasn't the staff of Moses nor the Ark of the Covenant for Joshua. It was the Spirit of God working in and through them to help them walk into the good future God had for them. So where does this story of Elijah and Elisha meet you today? Are you being called into an intentional mentoring relationship? If so, I'm sure Wayne Splon would love to chat with you. Are you being called to better cultivate your life in such a way that you're open and ready for the movement of God's Holy Spirit? Are you being asked to take off your mantle and put it down to share a few keys from your keychain with those God is calling to lead? Or perhaps you're being asked to pick up a few keys, to boldly grab hold of the mantle that's being handed to you and press forward into God's good future. Where now is the God of Elijah? Let us boldly and confidently answer, "Hear with us." And let us boldly and confidently cross over into the good future God has for us together.